This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. After Sandy Hook, many parents and students saw something different in their schools. Armed guards meant to help stave off attacks like the one that killed 20 students and 6 educators. But police and schools don't necessarily ensure safety. An armed sheriff's deputy was at Columbine High School in Colorado back in 1999. And many wonder about what message it sends to have an armed presence in what's meant to be a learning environment. Now, the federal government released a grant last year for some 300 school resource officers, a role that's meant to be much more than just a guard against violence. SROs, as they're known, are meant to be mentors and mediators, helping to calm disputes and weed out the potential for violence, for abuse, for drugs, and for crime. Today, Where We Live, a look at guards in schools. What do they do? Who pays for them? And do they make our schools safer? Coming up, we'll also look at controversies over in-school arrests. We'd like to hear from you, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Do you have guards at your school? Has anything changed since Sandy Hook? You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. As always, our program is online at WNPR.org. We'd love to hear your voice in this conversation. I want to welcome in Representative Jason Rojas, who's a state representative serving the 9th Assembly District. Thank you so much for being here, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Caleb Lopez is president of the Connecticut School Resource Officer Association. He's a police officer himself. Welcome, sir. Thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Caleb, let's start with you, and I'd love you to describe the day-to-day responsibilities of a school resource officer. What do you guys do?
Well, a school resource officer is a sworn police officer stationed or assigned to a school, and some towns, depending on their resources, may assign an SRO to cover multiple schools, like at the elementary school level or so forth. But typically, the SRO follows what we call the triad philosophy. So we are one-third law enforcement, one-third counselor, one-third teacher. So a typical day, take a typical morning might be teaching an internet safety class, followed by having to go to the main office to deal with two students who got into a shoving match and having a sit-down with them, mentoring them about the issues that led to this and coming to a resolution where they're actually shaking hands and at least agreeing to disagree, dealing with a situation where somebody maybe committed a larceny of some lunch money, and then followed by teaching another class on drug safety in an hour because then afterwards you have lunch cafeteria duty. So, and that's just your morning. And within that, you know, there's walking the hallways, popping into classes, getting dragged into a conversation in civics class because they happen to be talking about the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, and they figure the SRO is the guy to talk to. Mm-hmm. So it varies every day, but typically it's being a presence for both teachers, parents, and students, someone to that can be a resource, someone that can be a counselor, and as I said, a mediator, And pretty much, I mean, we end up wearing a lot of hats depending on the day. And some days are slower than others, but it's typically ever-changing.
I assume that in every district or in every state, really, SROs are different or they play a different role. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can describe, you know, the percentage of SROs who are armed versus not armed, people who work within a police force from the city or are completely independent of any sort of city law enforcement agency.
Well, typically, an SRO as defined is a police officer for that town, so they would be stationed in the school, armed, uniformed, you know, just like you would see a patrol officer out on the road. There are some communities, in fact, when the SRO program first started back in the 1950s, first started in Flint, Michigan, and then for a while, California instituted an SRO program. And at that time, it started out with plainclothes officers. But as evolution occurred, it was found that the idea of having uniformed officers was more effective simply because they stood out. They now are the one person that stands out in the school, and not just, you know, to kind of say, oh, there's a police officer here, you know, scare off the bad guys, but simply because now the kids knew who to go towards, made them more comfortable. You know, typically when we see a uniformed officer, everybody kind of, you know, perks up a little bit. The kids now get used to that, and so they see, okay, this is someone I can talk to, this is someone I can go to. So to have a truly defined SRO is to have a uniformed, armed officer within the school. outside of that, there are, for example, DARE officers. There are, as you had mentioned, security officers, all with different roles. Security officers would not be hired by the police department. They typically are hired by the district or private organization. DARE officers are police officers typically, but they may be in plain clothes because their role is more teaching / mentoring, going into different classes and teaching those curriculums. So, but the SRO, as defined, is a uniformed armed officer always within the school.
How much has any of this role changed in your mind since Sandy Hook?
I think there's been just more attention. Unfortunately, as often happens with any tragedy, the microscope goes on anyone or anything that can be associated with a tragedy like that. So obviously in this case, the issue of protection, officers in schools and so forth, goes under the limelight. And so people start really taking a closer look as to the effectiveness of SROs. Do we need them? Do we need just simply an armed security guard? If we do have SROs, how effective are they? Do we need more of them? Do we need less? Do we need them just in the elementary schools or in the high schools and middle schools? If anything, we just come under more of the microscope. Our roles don't change. We, if anything, maybe the schools might ask an SRO now to do a little more checking of the school grounds or ask them more about security questions than maybe before. Sometimes SROs will say, "Hey, I think you could change this and this." And in the past, maybe the school would be maybe a little like, "Yeah, we'll take care of it." Now, "Oh, you know that recommendation you made? I think we are going to take it now." So so there may be a more freer discussion now than there was maybe in the past.
I want to welcome in Representative Rojas here to talk about this because I think the definitions of what we're talking about are very important. We read that actually just last week the first selectman in Newtown, Pat Lodra, told the Board of Finance during a budget meeting she's planning to a budget for 9 armed retired police officers who will serve as armed security officers. That's SSOs, not SROs, in local schools beginning this September. That's coming from the Newtown Bee. So I think in many people's minds, somebody with a gun in school is somebody with a gun. I think we probably need to be clear about who's in what school, how we define these different roles. It might be a little bit confusing for parents and students, don't you think, Representative?
No, I definitely agree, and I think that's one of the main drivers of the legislation that we're considering this year is to kind of get a better definition of what it is we're trying to deal with here. Because whenever you don't have something defined or something clearly laid out, there's always the opportunity for the intent of a policy to move in the wrong direction. And I think it's up to every individual community. Communities have different preferences for what they'd like to see in their schools. After Sandy Hook, we saw a number of school districts grapple with the whole question of whether they wanted armed guards or armed officers in schools, period. Certainly there were parents, I think, in Enfield who had a lot of concerns about doing so. And certainly there are many districts throughout the state that already have them in school. So it's all a matter of what the community prefers and what the conversation that takes place around why we're having these officers in our schools.
So tell us a bit more about the legislation that you're talking about here, making it a little bit clearer as far as what the definitions are. I think that, as we've already said, it's going to be different from school to school, from district to district, but it does raise a lot of questions, including the ones about in-school arrests that we'll be talking about in just a little bit. Give me more specifics about what exactly your bill would do.
Yeah, so the legislation actually calls for whenever you're going to have a sworn police officer in the school, that an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, is done between the town and the school district so that the expectations are clearly laid out. We want to make sure that officers are in schools for these particular reasons, and we also want the administrators to recognize that they're officers first. They're there to enforce the law, and secondarily, they're there to serve as a resource to the school community. So I think it's important to lay out those expectations so that everybody's on the same page about what it is they want an officer to do in school. The MOU should dictate how a daily interaction between students, school personnel, and police officer takes place. They want to also lay out that there'll be a graduated response to incidents in the school rather than just simply responding with an arrest. Are there opportunities to use different interventions to deal with a particular issue that might be happening with a kid? Everybody interprets a situation differently, and we were talking earlier, we don't want to question the decision-making of police officers, but we also want to make sure that there are sometimes incidents that happen that perhaps don't rise to the level of a criminal offense that perhaps could be dealt more effectively through the regular school process. We also want to make sure that we're actually collecting data on this. Data is very important to determining what the exact problem is. And we want to make sure that schools are actually reporting that data to the State Department of Education so researchers and advocates can have a clearer picture of what's actually happening in our schools.
We'd like to hear from you if you have guards in your schools, whether they're SROs, SSOs, whether you have some sort of uniformed or plainclothes police force in your schools. We'd like to hear your stories about it. Has anything changed in your mind since Sandy Hook? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Let's go to the phones and talk to Jennifer in East Hartford. Hello, Jennifer. Go ahead. Hi, Jennifer. Are you there? I'm going to put Jennifer on hold, and hopefully we can reestablish her line. Alexander is in Guilford. Hi, Alexander.
Hi there. I've taught in schools that had school resource officers, and I've always been concerned about the training that they have. That is, do they have developmental, and this is partly in response to things that your first guest said, but do they have training in developmental psychology so that they know how to counsel students of this particular age? Do they have training in education or such things so that they are appropriate to be supervising children? Do they have training in pedagogy so that when they are brought into a classroom and serve in a teaching role, that they know a good way to deliver their lessons, a good way to address students to think about things such as gender bias and wait time and priming and scaffolding and all of that? Or are they basically trained to be some form of law enforcement that are then, and I know my bias is coming out here, but this comes from my experience, that are then put into positions for which they do not have professional training?
First of all, Alexander, thank you very much for your question. I'll put that to Caleb. He asks a lot of questions there, but he wants to, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners want to know, a bit more about the training that SROs get.
Absolutely. And that was a very all-encompassing question. And basically, we do start off as police officers, just like teachers or anybody else, to maintain certification, we have to have continual training. So as police officers, we do have we do get training when we're at the police academy, anything from juvenile law through police interactions with youth. Outside of the academy, we there are different programs and classes that we can seek out for professional development that involve anything from, again, police interactions with youth, in other words, dispelling myths and issues about youth, understanding their thinking motivations and so forth, and how to better communicate with them, how to better have better interactions. Once you become a school resource officer, it is very much encouraged. Right now, there is no requirement, but it is very much encouraged, and most departments that have SROs will do this. They will send them to typically a week-long, if not longer, course on SRO. Basically, SRO training. There's typically basic SRO training and then advanced SRO training.
But I'll just break in and say so. Essentially, these are things that are encouraged and they're not mandated. I'll just go to the representative very quickly. We're seeing in our state right now this massive conversation about education standards, about whether or not the teachers who teach our kids are qualified to teach our kids, and how we're going to evaluate them on a day by day, week by week, month by month basis. Do you think that we need to have the same sort of standards if police officers are going to be in our schools in terms of professional training, not just a week-long course but that's encouraged, but something that is mandated that's much different than what Caleb's talking about here?
Yeah, no, I think it's a conversation that has to happen. We were actually talking before we came up here. I asked the question about, you know, during your post-training or police academy, do you get training in any of these areas and how to work with youth? And I think there's an opportunity to do that. I think anytime you talk about mandating something like that, it raises all sorts of concerns, I think, for police officers and the chiefs of police and how training takes place, because at the end of the day, their primary responsibility is to enforce laws and ensure public safety. And as we move in the direction of having more officers in our schools, I think it's certainly worth the conversation about whether we should standardize the kind of training that they get so we can ensure the best outcomes for them and for kids.
And Colby, you understand my question, of course. Right now, you're teaching essentially alongside teachers who are being told that they have to meet a whole panoply of requirements in order to keep their job, in order to make sure that they're passing muster. And obviously, they would want to think that anybody else who's an educator in their schools, even if they're coming from the police force, should have the same sort of training and that stuff.
No, I understand the concern. And definitely, when an SRO is put into that situation, my experience is most SROs that I have come in contact with will seek out, as time and resources permit, any and all professional development that will help them better in the classroom. The Police Academy offers a method of instruction, a week-long class, to basically teach officers how to create lesson plans and so forth, how to teach in front of a classroom. And on top of that, the SRO basic classes that are done, whether it's through the National Association of School Resource Officers, through one that we have here in Connecticut, through the Spectre Training Group, they have their facets in child psychology, child development, mentoring. It's a lot to put, because obviously we're law enforcement. Our main profession is law enforcement. It's not teaching. We're trying to squeeze as much as we can in a short amount of time to give us as much as many tools as possible to deal effectively with youth, while at the same time still carrying on our basic job of being a police officer. And I do understand the concerns that people have of, well, you're putting an officer who's only having a couple of weeks worth of training for this, whereas teachers spend, 4 or 5 years and 6 years. And all I can say is that we definitely would never take on something, or hopefully we would never take on something that we're not properly ready for and trained for. A lot of times we depend on the teachers. An SRO will sit down with a teacher and say, hey, listen, I know I'm supposed to be teaching in your classroom. What are you looking for? What are your suggestions in terms of approaching this subject? And then we'll go back, we'll create a lesson plan. A lot of times we'll have supervisors who may sift through the lesson plan and say, okay, this is appropriate, this is not appropriate, and so forth. So there's things we do to prepare ourselves. And a lot of times as we are in the school, we continue that training, and there's tons out there.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of money and time.
I would say that's why the MOU is so important. It lays out those expectations so that the school community plus the police officer community knows exactly what's expected of them.
A quick phone call here from Bill, who's calling from Litchfield County. Hi there, Bill.
Yes, hi. I have a question and a comment. My first question is, what is the cost for an SRO to a community? And my comment has to do with my experience in trying to increase security at my daughter's school. And one of the key questions that came up is about police response times. And when I am in, my daughter attends a school in a rural community that does not have its own police force. And one of the problems is that at this time, with budget cuts and such, a police response time is woefully inadequate when you take into consideration all the tragedies that have occurred since Sandy Hook. So to really be able to discuss whether there should be an SRO or not, one thing that's not discussed in our community and should be discussed, and I'm sure that's probably true in many communities, is how long would it take for the police to respond to an emergency?
So two good questions, Bill. First, thank you very much. So his first question has to do with cost, and maybe we'll just table that for a second because we want to get to that later in the program. We're going to have Joe Cirasolo from superintendents across the state talking a bit about cost. So how about this question of police response time?
It's a very good one. It's a tough one. It obviously there's many factors that could determine a response time. Everything from just speaking of an SRO, a school that does not have an SRO, so does not have an officer in there. If a school requires an officer, where the patrol officer that has that school and it's in their district, where are they? Are they right down the street or are they on the other side? Are they responding to a call or are they just patrolling and unable to just immediately go there? How many officers are required and therefore how many officers need to come from different areas in town? Traffic, volume of calls. Obviously, when it comes to schools, I know at least in my community as well as in many, I think in most communities, anytime the dispatch says something's happened in ABC school, that goes to the top of the list over anything and everything. I may be in the middle of a traffic stop and that person is getting away with a verbal warning because that school now has my ultimate attention.
I think one of the things that Bill is asking about, though, is if you have a school resource officer or a security officer of some sort on a campus, does it change the ability for police to respond quickly overall to something that's happening on a school versus if you didn't have anybody on a campus or at a school and you just had to come from the outside and fight all this traffic and everything else you're talking about?
And obviously, you know, Murphy's Law being what it is, if the SRO already is in the building, obviously that's increasing your response time and being able to attend to whatever issue is going on. Even that has its issues. If something's going on and the SRO happens to be in one end of the building and communication, by the time it gets to the SRO that something's happening. The other aspect of it is the SRO just happens that one moment to step out just to drop off paperwork at the station, and that's when something happens, and now they have to, just like any other officer, drive back. So anything can affect response times. Ideally, if the SRO is in the building, that's going to decrease, and now you have a presence to help that much quicker.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about this. We want to hear your stories. But do you have armed guards in your local school? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's a bad idea? What do you think about the potential for in-school arrests going up by having school resources officers on staff? Caleb Lopez is here. He's from the Connecticut School Resource Officer Association. Representative Jason Rojas also joins us to talk a bit about the legislation that he's proposed. We do want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about armed guards in schools. In some places, they're SROs, school resource officers. In some places, they're school security officers. We're seeing more and more of them, not just in Connecticut, but around the country following the shootings, first at Columbine and then again at Sandy Hook. Do they work in your school? Do you think that we should have more of them? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. In just a moment, we're going to talk a bit about some of the controversy surrounding arrests that happen in school. I first want to get to Thomas, who's calling from Storrs. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, John.
Yeah.
I guess I should start out by saying I have the utmost respect for law enforcement officers. My grandfather was a captain in the NYPD. But I guess in my experience from attending high school in Florida, I had a lot of bad experiences, not personally, but in terms of, from a public policy standpoint, how school resource officers engaged with the student body. It seemed like the way that school administrations and the school board, at least in my county, would, you know, basically, I guess if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, where there were numerous instances on a very regular basis of students being arrested for extremely minor infractions that historically would have been, you know, treated with a suspension or a detention for a student that students were, you know, actually arrested and put into the criminal justice system for. Not in my own county, but there were students in recent years who have been arrested for farting and for a science project that apparently went awry, and several other things to that regard. And also, I guess on a similar level, the level of, I guess, intimidation that some students, myself included, felt from having a officer who would, and I very much understand the motivation behind it, but an officer who would stand at the front door openly carrying, you know, as well as, or in addition to his sidearm, a billy club and pepper spray, which every time I noticed, I would wonder why that was necessary to be, you know, and a taser as well, necessary that, you know, he would have to be so heavily armed, because it felt very intimidating to have that person, you know, walking next to you in classes each day.
And again, Thomas, I just want to make sure I understand. This was you going to school in Florida, you'd see this?
Yes, I was a high school student for my last 3 years of high school in Florida, and that was a very common experience. I think Florida, of the high schools, at least in my county, I went to school in Pinellas County, I believe that they have them at all high school and middle schools. They have one or two SROs.
First of all, Thomas, I think you raise a lot of really good points. I also think we can fairly say that Florida is a very different place than Connecticut in a lot of ways. But you raise some good issues that I want to actually put to Marissa Holm, who's director of the Team Child Juvenile Justice Project. Marissa joins us by phone. Thank you very much for being here and Where We Live. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I think Tom brings up some very, very good and very salient points, you know, when we're looking at the presence of police in our schools. You know, the concern related to that is exactly as Tom indicated. When police are in our schools, it is inevitable that students are being arrested in many cases for minor offenses that could have been dealt, you know, with the proper training through the behavior management in the schools. And that is something that we have seen here in Connecticut. Our organization has done extensive work in the cities of Bridgeport and Hartford, for example, through our disproportionate minority reduction projects, working specifically on reducing school-based arrests for inappropriate offenses. You know, very common to have students being arrested as a breach of peace second for normal adolescent behavior, talking back to a teacher and, you know, continuing to escalate verbally.
When you say, and I'll just stop you real quick, Marisa, because I want to make sure I understand. When you say very common, like, give us some numbers. How common is this? How often does this happen?
Well, for example, in the city of Hartford, I think the first year, that the year from 2011-12 school year, I think there were something like 140 incidents of school-based arrests, okay? And the subsequent, which was a large portion, I think over 40% of the total arrests in the city of Hartford of juveniles. The subsequent year, through the work that we did in terms of establishing an MOU and working on training the police and having their roles be circumcised and very clear and deferring to school administration when it comes to discipline, we had reduced those numbers down to, you know, under 70.
I'm wondering, Representative Rojas, as you take a look at this, is this something that you've heard from constituents? Is this a concern that you're trying to address in the legislation that you've proposed? Obviously, we've heard it not just from Marisa, but from other people in Connecticut and around the country.
Yeah, I mean, it actually started back when I was on the town council in East Hartford. We had an issue there where there was a police report where there were 140 students arrested at our high school. Obviously, that's of concern to me. One, we want to do whatever we can to mitigate the kind of school-to-prison pipeline that I think a lot of people will tell you exists. We just began to ask the questions of why is this happening? And a lot of it is the legacy of zero tolerance policies back from the 1980s and 1990s in terms of how we address juvenile crime, particularly juvenile crime when it involves African-American or Latino males. And a lot of that's the legacy of this. And I actually, the Connecticut Voices for Children did a pretty extensive report on school-based arrests last year. And, you know, from the research they did, 10% of it, 10% of the arrests of the about approximately 3,000 arrests that take place every year in our schools, 10% of them were categorized as arrests that really didn't need to happen, you know, skipping class, insubordination, using profanity. Another quarter of those arrests were behaviors that were at best questionably necessary as they've done it, a physical altercation where there was no injuries, bullying, obscene behavior, or doing a false alarm. So already you're talking about 35% of those 3,000 arrests are probably arrests that really didn't need to happen.
So, Marisa, before I get back to you, Caleb, I'd just like for you to respond to this. I mean, do you hear these numbers and do you think that this is something that massively needs to change within the organization that you're a part of? Or do you think that people are making too much of numbers like this? I'd love to get your response.
There's a lot of different facets in there. But to two main points, the issue of the arrest, I agree that there are times when, for whatever reason, and again, I, not knowing the facts of what occurred during an incident involving a child and an officer, I'm not going to second guess and try to throw my spin on it. Mistakes happen, lack of training, lack of forethought or knowledge in a particular situation may lead to an officer making an arrest where someone else may say, you know what, we could have dealt with it maybe in a different manner. And like anything else, you know, it becomes an issue of a learning moment where things maybe could be done differently at a different time. However, one of the things about statistics and so forth is that, for example, and we were discussing this, and Mr. Rojas and I, you know, for example, the issue of profanity. A report might say, a piece of paper might say that the child was arrested for profanity, when in reality, the police report will say, or whatever other report and witness accounts might say, that this child was using racial language and or severe obscenities after multiple interventions by staff and so forth to try to control that behavior, to curb the behavior, maybe singling out a particular child or group of children. And it got to such a point that it became a disruption to the learning environment of the school.
But it's an arrest. I guess my question is an arrest the thing that takes care of that? In the wider public on the street, does repeated profanity, even extreme profanity, get you arrested all the time? And that's, I think, one of the concerns about this, because you do want to make sure that nothing escalates. You do want to make sure that a situation does not turn violent in a school, certainly, and there's maybe only one SRO there in order to handle this. But does an arrest necessarily need to follow from that?
Well, here's the thing. An arrest for an adult is different than an arrest for a juvenile. An arrest for an adult, we merely think, you know, cuffs and going to jail and all that stuff. For a juvenile, and unfortunately it's a weird choice of words, but juvenile arrest, juvenile summons, is going to court where their first and only interaction might be with a probation officer, who's essentially just another adult who says, listen, we're going to instill some rules here. You're going to have a curfew. You're going to have to do your homework. You're going to have to follow house rules. And it's almost like family court. And the whole idea is to get that kid back on track. It is a last resort that we use. It is often not the first thing we do. And if there is an arrest, a lot of times if you follow the chain, you'll see that there were multiple other interactions, maybe a juvenile review board prior to this, maybe multiple times of mentoring, counseling, and so forth through the school. Again, not knowing each individual.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, confidentiality for students makes the numbers kind of funky. Yeah, you can see stats about arrests and so forth, but the context of those arrests, and I'm not saying that mistakes don't occur and lack of, again, training doesn't affect some of these. But overall, my experience has been that the SROs will use something like that as a last resort.
I want to get a response from Marissa Holm.
Yes. One point I'd really like to bring up is, and I agree completely, that arrest should be the absolute last resort. An arrest in a school environment should be limited really to those emergency response or criminal situations. Once the juvenile justice system is in fact rehabilitative, that's the purpose of it, but the fact of the matter is once a child touches that system and enters that system, there is a negative spiral. So it's connected to them not finishing school. It's connected to them reoffending. So we would like to prevent their entrance into the juvenile justice system in the first place. And I think that the way that we remedy that, if police are going to be in our schools, is really there needs to be extensive training of any police officer that's going to be stationed within a school, and there needs to be very clear-cut roles as to what the police is responsible versus the school staff, and there are different tools out there. For example, the school-based diversion initiative, which is a project that goes into schools and helps provide training and behavior management both for teachers and administrative staff. Those are the sorts of things that we need to, you know, focus on, as opposed to arresting a child for vulgar language.
So but maybe you can give me some more specifics. If we try to put together a program to have better training, because I think we've all said that Officer Lopez was saying sometimes this might happen because an officer doesn't have the training as someone else. If you've been at this a lot longer, you might know how to handle the situation better, but we don't mandate anything really. We're encouraging certain amounts of training. So if you were writing the law, Marissa, and you had a magic wand, what training would you ask for?
Well, so, for example, I mean, I think we would start, our office has been very involved in promoting legislation, SB 54, requiring when there are police in schools to have a memorandum of understanding between the police department and the school administration. So that would be number one. And we have found that and within that memorandum of understanding, towns can create the specifics that are appropriate for their town, but within there, training opportunities are detailed, and that serves as the framework for the relationship. So first and foremost, if police are going to be in our schools, there needs to be communication and collaboration between the police department and the superintendent and or administration. And then there needs to be a written agreement detailing that. In terms of specific training opportunities, I think there's training both for school staff as well as for school resource officers. And that training is not, in fact, mandated here in Connecticut. I don't know if I missed Mr. Lopez talking about the importance of that, but components of that would be on development, you know, how to interact developmentally appropriately with youth, what are some other positive intervention strategies that we can utilize before, you know, moving to an arrest or a ticket or a summons.
Well, and I think we did talk about that, but again, we talked about these things as being offered to police officers, not necessarily mandated. I quickly want to get to just a few phone calls here. A lot of people want to join our conversation, including Pat and Franklin. Hi, Pat, go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm 45 years old, and when I went to school, we didn't have locked doors, we didn't have security drills, and have armed police officers. Something's changed in society, and something has seriously changed, therefore, in our children. And I think when we become honest and we work out to the symptoms of that topic, I think going forward, the topic of police and schools, hopefully, will become a moot point.
Pat, thank you very much for that. Quickly, Jamie in Berlin is on the line. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment about the use of resources and how they might, you know, how potentially putting more guidance counselors or even social workers into a school system might avoid a child from getting into these behavioral problems in advance versus correcting or addressing them once they happen.
That's a really good question. Representative?
Yeah, no, we could bring up the example in Manchester. There's a program, an initiative called Manchester Agencies Police and Schools. It's a group of adults who get together, representatives from the Board of Education, from the administration, from the Youth Service Bureau, from the police department, from DCF, from Court Support Services, Public Defender's Office, all of those. They're getting together on a regular basis to look at the data of what's happening in Manchester and to begin to look at the individual students that they're dealing with, because at the end of the day, we're talking about a small population of students that generally most schools deal with when they're dealing with troubled youth, and they're beginning to focus on them. What kind of different interventions can take place? How do we engage the family? How do we direct them in a different route? How do we keep them out of the criminal justice system? Because we know a lot of these kids are experiencing trauma at a very young age, and when they do that, there's a lot of research that shows that has implications for the rest of their life, and a lot of what we're seeing has to do with an inability to read, a learning disability, an emotional disability, an undiagnosed psychological impairment. And, you know, for a long time, we've just haven't asked the questions as to, is that what's happening in this child's life? The easier thing to do is just to simply arrest them and get them out of the school. And one of the problems we have when an arrest takes place in the school, there's often a suspension that goes along with that. So every time we have children out of a school building for an extended period of time, we're falling farther and farther behind.
They're not learning. They're someplace maybe doing something they shouldn't be doing, officer.
If I could add to that, I firmly agree that, you know, we've been talking about the training of police officers and the arrests and so forth, but the police officers in the schools have a partnership with the school, with the school district. We have, because we're the outsiders, we have all these resources at our disposal. Everything from the, you know, DCF, you know, special phone number that's not the hotline, to youth and family services, to, you know, we're the clearinghouse sometimes of all this information. That sometimes the guidance will come to us and say, you know, I got this kid and I got the situation. What do you think might be the best resource? And we talk and. A lot of resource officers will have regular interactions, will be part of the PPTs, and will be part of discussions about a particular student. Like you said, you know, Ms. Rojas, about, you know, a child that has some other issues going on at home that is affecting learning, mental health issues, and so forth. And we are able to say, yeah, we are aware of some family issues. We are aware of some things that you need to know as a school so you can better serve this child. The other thing, going back to the training, you know, there are organizations such as CABLE, which is the Connecticut Alliance to Benefit Law Enforcement, and they offer training for law enforcement specifically in dealing with mental health issues dealing with children, how to better deal with the situation so that we can become essentially mediators and bring down a situation, talk to a child so that child does not end up in the juvenile system, but in turn gets the appropriate help. It's a fantastic training that eventually, you know, I think more in law enforcement will get. But there are things that are out there that we are trying to add to our tool belt, as it were, to better serve these kids. And ultimately, yeah, our goal is to keep them out of the juvenile system.
Marisa Holm, I just have a moment left with you. So if we're moving forward, we're talking about more training, certainly for officers. We're talking about making sure that we have some sort of standards for what they're doing in the school, what their relationship is with the school. That's what the representative is talking about. Is there one last thought that you want to leave us with here? Because a lot of school districts are looking to have police in their schools for a lot of the reasons that we've talked about today. What's one more thing that you think we need to think about?
Another example of important training I think that occurred in the city of Hartford with the Hartford Police Department is they trained. We've heard about mental health issues and unmet mental health needs and educational needs. That is a very important component. 70% of our youth that end up in the juvenile justice system have some sort of, you know, learning disability or learning difficulty. A component of training that has been very helpful for the Hartford Police Department, Hartford Police Force, is getting trained on the use of emergency mobile psychiatric services, EMPS, as a way to respond to a child that may be escalating and may have more needs. And that is a more appropriate route to go in certain situations as opposed to proceeding to an arrest.
Marisa Holm is director of the Team Child Juvenile Justice Project. She joined us by phone. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with school superintendents about the costs of all this and whether or not we have indeed seen a rise in armed school guards across Connecticut since Sandy Hook. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. As always, we'll be joined by Colin McEnroe with the panel of reporters. Amongst the things we'll be talking about at the state capitol, public hearings on two Freedom of Information bills have made almost as much news as the bills themselves. We'll be talking about that. And also, of course, the father of the Newtown shooter is now speaking out about his son. What new information did we learn from that New Yorker piece? That and more coming up tomorrow on The Wheelhouse. Today we're talking about armed guards in schools. Sometimes they're called SROs, school resource officers. In other places, they're school security officers. We want to hear if you have them in your school, 860-275-7266. Quickly, I want to go to Dr. Joseph Cirasolo, who is executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. He joins us once again. Doctor, thank you so much for coming back.
My pleasure.
So a couple quick questions for you. Do we indeed have more schools and school districts using officers in the school than we did before Sandy Hook?
We have a slight increase. There's no question about that. A few more school resource officers, a few more school districts actually putting armed security in the schools.
As far as the cost, whenever we look at a school budget, that's a very important thing. How are we paying for these increased officers in schools? Is that coming from grant money? Where are we getting the money from?
Very little grant money is available for that. There used to be, after the Columbine tragedy years ago, a lot of federal money for school resource officers. That's more or less dried up. There's a little bit you can use, but the burden has been on the local taxpayer.
When you say local taxpayer, how much money are we talking about? I mean, if you have one school resource officer in a school, you know, all year round, what does that cost you?
You're probably looking at somewhere between $60,000 and $75,000, depending on what arrangements can be made with the local police department. Because remember, the school resource officers, you just don't pick an officer and put them in a school. They have to go through a training. There has to be ongoing training. Has to be somebody that the local police department can free up. And that means some money for the police department to replace that person. Now, if you're talking about armed security guards, really, it can be all over the place, depending on how many you're going to have and how many schools you're going to cover. If you're going to cover every school in a fairly large school district, you're looking at six figures easily. Short of that, it could be anything from, say, $20,000-$30,000 on up to a couple hundred thousand.
We've been talking with Representative Rojas here, who's got a bill to establish clear understanding of responsibilities of law enforcement in schools. Is that the sort of thing that the school superintendents can get behind?
Well, it depends on what the specifications of the bill are. We are very much in favor of an agreement between the local police department and the school system as to what the school system will handle in terms of behavior that's not appropriate, and what actually rises to the level of the kind of criminal offense you want to refer to the police. That's usually in place in most places. We really, frankly, haven't looked at the specifics of the bill yet, but the thrust of it is something that we would agree with.
I'm wondering, I'm sure you've listened to some of this conversation here. We've been talking about the problem of in-school arrests. We've been talking about providing security first and foremost. I'm wondering from your standpoint, Doctor, how you think we should be thinking about this issue, maybe a little differently than we are, because it sounds as though there's still a lot of controversy about the way this is handled in a lot of school districts.
Well, we ran a symposium on school security over a year ago, and one of the major recommendations, these are national experts on school security who came to the symposium. One of the big recommendations we received was be very, very careful when you're going to put armed security in a school. School resource officers trained to be SROs, good idea. If you're going to go in any other direction, you really need to make darn sure that the people you bring in are trained to work in a school. You just can't bring anybody in who's been a guard at a mall or someplace else. So our advice to our members is be very, very careful about that, especially when it comes to who do you refer to the criminal justice system and who you don't. You don't want to have situations that the school would normally handle now all of a sudden become a police matter. You only want to refer things to the police department, as I said, when there's a serious criminal offense that you would refer to them if you didn't have security guards there.
This idea of training has come up over and over again.
Yep.
One of the problems I think a lot of people are seeing with this is that police are certainly trained to be police, but they're trained a little bit to be school resource officers compared to the amount of training that our teachers now have to go through and the amount of supervision that our teachers have to go through. Do you think that the balance is struck right there, Doctor? Do you think that maybe we need to provide more training for people who are going to serve in schools?
Well, you could always use more training, but the history on SROs is pretty good. Where they have been used, they really have become members of the staff. They have become sort of adjunct guidance counselors. They've gotten to know the students and frequently have picked up on things that the school could then become aware of and intervene before they became major problems. So I'm pretty comfortable with the training that school resource officers get. It can always be better than that. As I said, you know, as far as the other folks are concerned, the other kinds of security guards, it varies, and it's something that you need to be concerned about.
I just have a minute or so, but a few more people want to get involved. Sean is calling from Greenwich. Sean, we just have about a minute or so. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I actually, when Greenwich was considering bringing a school resource officer into Greenwich High School, I was troubled by that and actually went out to all the DRG A and B schools and asked about their experience. And I was troubled that a school in a community like Greenwich, which was one of the safest in the nation, which had no problems with violence, would actually put a police officer in there. I think we keep that the police officer is a part of the community and someone who's trusted, and yet what we still see is a high level of arrests, a high level of Hispanics and blacks being arrested relative to the rate for whites or Asians. And I think there is very little research to show that they're helpful. In fact, the ACLU of Connecticut did a study showing that for the same offense, school resource officers in the Hartford area were more likely to arrest a child who was black or Hispanic than a kid who was white or Asian.
And thank you, Sean. Joe, I'm wondering if you could very quickly respond to that.
I think before you compare the kind of statistics that were talked about, you need to look at why the people were being arrested. If minority children are being arrested for things that white children are not being arrested for, it's a problem. But on the other hand, if a white child commits a particular act and so does a minority child and they both get arrested, well, that's a different ballgame. The history on school resource officers across the country has been unbalanced positive. There's always situations you can refer to that are negative, but we're comfortable recommending SROs to school districts.
Dr. Joseph Sarasolo from the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, thank you for your time. I also want to thank Representative Jason Rojas and Caleb Lopez from the Connecticut School Resource Officer Association. Continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. This is Where We Live.